Here I am. Charles Seif is my guest. What a guest, huh? What a guest. He deserves some plugs. He's got some books. Decoding the Universe is one of them. That should be very interesting. You can go look for these, of course, on Amazon.com. Decoding the Universe. If you've enjoyed the interview, you're certainly going to want to read the books. Or Alpha and Omega, The Search for the Beginning and End of the Universe. We'll have to ask about that. And Zero, The Biography of a Dangerous Idea. There are shows in all those books. Michael in Iowa City, Iowa says, "Hey, Art, were you afraid to be born? Why would you be afraid to die?" Now, somebody said that sleep is a little slice of death, I think, right? So, honestly, Michael, I'm not afraid to die. Not at all. I'm not afraid of, even if the answer is that death represents a great nothingness, I'm no more afraid to die than I would be to go to sleep at night. I am a little concerned about the prospect of a painful death, however. And then David, I think, has a good one from Kingman, Arizona, for Charles. And he says, proteins cannot self-assemble without DNA. DNA is God's assembly instructions. DNA, therefore, is proof of God, our creator. In a moment, we'll ask about it. Okay, Charles, David's question is, proteins cannot self-assemble without DNA. DNA is God's assembly instructions. DNA is proof of God, our creator. How would you respond to that?
Well, I'd say David is absolutely correct that especially complex proteins cannot just self-assemble. That DNA, the point of DNA is to give instructions for creating proteins that wind up being parts of our cells. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, I mean, there's an instruction set there. Where do the instructions come from? Mm-hmm. And some people would argue that they came initially from God, and that is one set of beliefs. Biology can operate without that assumption, though. It is possible that these instruction sets evolved over time, started off by kind of being a random conglomeration of RNA, just small, simple chemicals that self-replicate, and then over time, just through random processes, get more and more complex until you get life. Of course, this is something that biologists don't understand very well at this point. It's not a very satisfactory explanation. But I think that biology doesn't necessarily need a God. If you have a God, though, all of a sudden becomes very simple to explain. So, I mean, David does definitely have a point, but there is a hole in biology asking where did these instructions come from? This information gathers over time, but it has to start somewhere. And I think if you ask most biologists, they'd say it's a random process, but I know that there are a lot of biologists who would say, yes, in fact, God was the first instructor, that the instructions that came from God.
You just don't believe that.
I don't tend to. I tend mm-hmm. to think it's a random process. But again, it's something that it's not a great answer. It's something of a cop out. Just as in some sense, saying it's God is a cop out. You always get to the edge of your knowledge, and then you have to punt somehow and take a guess.
Yeah. And you heard the comment about death, right?
Yes.
Are you afraid of death?
I'm afraid of death in the same way that most humans are. That. Want to avoid it and push it off as long as possible, but I don't fear death in the sense that I think I'm pretty much in agreement with you that I don't want pain, but I expect it'll be unconsciousness and won't be that unpleasant. I mean, considering how much time I want to spend sleeping, I expect it wouldn't be so bad.
In the interest of time, I'll ask this quickly, but I can't not ask it. How do you think the universe... our universe will end?
Well, the universe will end in a heat death, what's known as a heat death, that the universe expands further and further. The stars burn out and die. The information dissipates, that everything gets colder and more rarefied. Everything gets spread out. The stars dim out one by one. The sky goes black. We become a lifeless soup of nothingness.
How attractive.
Yeah.
How much time do we have before the effects of that make it unlivable for us?
No one really knows that Earth becomes unlivable in about 1 billion years. The sun gets hotter and hotter, the oceans boil off, and then it becomes unlivable. Assuming we could, as humans, get very advanced and can move elsewhere, as stars begin to burn out. I mean, they're already burning out a bit, but there's new generations of stars that are born. In terms of computing, one of the things about information is you can actually consider the universe as a information processor. And in terms of information processing, the universe is about half done.
About
That,
half done.
yeah, it's about 10 to the 120 operations before us, and about 10 to the 120 operations that can be done after us. So we're, in some sense, at a cosmic midpoint.
Maybe we're having a midlife crisis.
Yeah, I'd love to see what happens when the universe buys its car. I'd love to see it.
Here we go. Wildcard line, Sandra in Cleveland, Ohio. You're on the air with Charles Seif.
Yes, hello there. I have a couple of things I'd like Charles to comment on, if he can. The first one is about his superimposition of the two cellophane interwoven universes and the alive but dead cat. Could this explain why so many people have clear, detailed memory of a famous individual having died, and yet many others have the same clear memory of that individual still being alive? And the second thing I wanted to bring up, and this might have to do with those universes also. Just for background, I work as a professional psychic, but I've also worked in the medical sciences. And when I do a psychic consultation for someone, I usually sense and sometimes mentally see several future possibilities for that person, right down to the percentage of potential of each of those possibilities happening or manifesting for that person, at least at that moment of the reading. And then sometimes that individual will come back in a month or several months, and without a word from them, I'll sense that something has changed, and I'll ask, "What have you done differently about such and so?" And most times the reply is, "Well, nothing, but I did make a decision. I haven't acted on it yet, but I made a decision." So I'm wondering if I'm somehow scanning these other universes of potential futures, and that they, by simply these people, simply by changing their consciousness or shifting their mental and emotional positions, that these people are beginning to experience that alternate universe already.
All right. Go ahead,
Well,
Charles.
the first question you first was, I guess, the famous people. I'll call it the Abe Vigoda question, because lots of people think Abe Vigoda's dead. If in fact there were parallel universes that, I mean, that interact and people were able to sense these different things. So scientists kind of think of these parallel universes, the quantum effects, as operating on a subatomic scale and not on a macroscopic scale. But if in fact there were something like that, yes, in fact, you might have the sense that a celebrity were some half living, half dead, and when the universe splits, some see the living, some see the dead. And if they were able to communicate, there might be this confusion. But part of the problem with Schrodinger's cat is that it turns out that for large objects, the universe is always kind of doing this measurement. So the splits are happening constantly. It's unlikely that a macroscopic object like a celebrity would be in superposition. For the second question, for the future possibilities, what you're describing, I mean, it is consistent with what the quantum mechanical explanation is. Every time you do a measurement, or every time a scientist looks at something, it changes the what's called the wave function, that the positions where something might be. And every time that there's a measurement, it affects the wave function, and the probabilities change. So, what you're describing is not in conflict with quantum mechanics. Whether or not the quantum mechanics explains what you're seeing, I'll remain neutral. But what you're I could imagine if you were looking at, say, the position of an atom, successive measurements would change the probabilities of where the atom is.
All right. East of the Rockies, Michael in Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi. Thank you. Very fascinating discussion tonight. The only problem with having such good questions and such wonderful answers is it requires two or three additional programs of the best experts that can be found in the world just to deal with what you've already dealt with on the program by the time we get to the question and answer part.
I agree.
But I would like to say this. You talked earlier about Schrodinger's cat. You talked about the Pear Lab at Princeton, which Dean Radin has so much talked about when he's come on this program.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are some parallel problems in that. I would like to suggest an experiment, which was actually suggested by the foremost Christian philosopher in the world today, a man by the name of Ravi Zacharias. I'll talk about his experiment as I deal first very quickly with this Schrodinger's cat problem and the pear lab problem that has not been ever discussed on any of the programs that Coast to Coast has done. The problem is this. None of the discussions have taken into account what effect non-human intelligence minds could have about the knowledge of emerging events and therefore affect the computer at Princeton. They don't take into account what guardian angels, for example, might be communicating as a network of minds about events that are emerging in New York and how that would affect the computer. They don't take into account the possibility of a great universal mind whom we refer to as the great creator God. So from the standpoint of a Christian philosopher like Ravi Zacharias or a Billy Graham, who is not a philosopher in the discipline sense, but certainly a wonderful Christian apologist in another sense, from their standpoint, what you are doing as you discuss these experiments is leaving out something that any objective scientist would have to be factoring in if he were truly objective.
Michael, I think to be fair, Michael, to the people at Princeton, I don't think that they're making any absolute statements about what it is.
Well, no, I'm not saying that they are making. I'm just saying that our discussions on the radio do not try to account for this. Now, Hugh Ross has begun assembling in a group of scientists, and the reason I bring in Ravi Zacharias is because at Ivy League universities, at Oxford, at Cambridge, at all of the great universities of the Western world, he is without question, the most fascinating, the most in demand, the most powerful apologist who is combining both science and religion in a way that is so effective that the rest of the world just doesn't know how to deal with it. So what
okay,
I'm
well,
saying is
listen, Michael, I'm with you. I don't think I'm going to try and argue with faith, and I'm certain that Charles isn't. Are you, Charles?
No. Although, the point is interesting, that the idea
yeah.
of isolating what is doing the measurement, whether you believe in guardian angels, this is something that scientists have to deal with. What is a measurement? Is it a measurement when a human intelligence observes something? Is it just necessary that an instrument observes something? Or is it even below that? Does nature observe something? And this is something that scientists are struggling with. So it is a profound question.
It really is, sure. West of the Rockies, Richard in California, you're on with Charles.
Hello, Charles.
Hello.
My question is on the understanding of the perception of distance and space. And I know that at the speed of light, all distances are zero. And that and with quantum entanglement, you have two particles with pretty much no separation between them, in a sense. So my question is the perception of consciousness of the distance of separation, is it connected to the speed of light? And are we perceiving the separation of space and time through consciousness or not? I know it's a strange question, but I've always struggled with that. So.
No, it's a very good question. I mean, one of the weird things about relativity, and you allude to this, is that the faster you go, as you move through space, you're changing your motion through time, and you're changing certain properties. The faster you go, the smaller outside things look, or in fact, the smaller they are. That if you are going close to the speed of light, someone holding a yardstick, it could be just a few inches long from your perception. This is actually independent of consciousness. It does not need to have a conscious observer. It just is smaller. That an unconscious instrument trying to measure that yardstick would see it as a few inches in length. Consciousness is really tricky, and some scientists like Hameroff, who is working with Roger Penrose, believes that there is a quantum component to consciousness, that perhaps there is something in our brain that is exploiting quantum computation that gives us this emergent property of consciousness. It's not a terribly well-developed theory at this point, and it seems that it probably is not correct, but, you know, scientists are arguing about this all the time. So what role perception plays and what role quantum mechanics plays in consciousness is a real open question.
International line, Julia in Toronto, Canada.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Good morning. Oh, good morning, gentlemen. Could I ask Charles to elaborate a little bit on the statement that you made? I'm not sure if I heard it correctly, but this is my interpretation of what I thought I heard. When we make a radical decision that changes the direction of our life, we create another universe where we...
Okay, I was the one who said radical, just to make the point. Charles made the point that it could be any decision.
Okay, that we create another universe. We're then living in that split universe. Did I get that correct?
That's pretty much correct. Although we're not creating the universe, that universe already exists. That it's just stuck to our universe. And by making a measurement, making a decision, taking an action, it need not even be a decision, one of these cellophane universes splits off from the other. And in one universe, there's a one copy of us, and in another universe, there's another copy of us. It's a really bizarre idea that there's many copies of us doing many different things at the same time.
And it suggests a kind of immortality.
Yes, yes. And one of the things that one of the researchers I know, Max Tegmark, who's at MIT, has come up with an idea that he thinks might prove the idea of parallel universes, and it's a quantum suicide experiment.
Wait a minute, a quantum suicide experiment?
Yes, yes. By trying to commit suicide, if you're unable to do it, you're proving your immortality in a sense, and showing that the universe is splitting and that you are in this. You are immortal. I'm oversimplifying, but that's the essence of it.
I'm going to have to ask more about that when we get back, and we will be back. We've got one more segment to go. We could do show after show, as that caller suggested. We could do night after night on this on these topics. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Wonder what's so dangerous about zero? We'll ask about that in a moment. That's one of his books, actually, Zero, the Biography of a Dangerous Idea. Charles Seif is my guest. He'll be back in just a moment. You know, you're such a good guest, Charles, that I've never done this before, but what are you doing next weekend?
Next weekend, let me check my calendar. I think I should be okay. I could come back if you'd like.
I'd like.
I would too.
There's so much. We've covered so much and not in enough detail. Let me check with my producer and see what I can do.
Oh, I'd love to do it.
All right. No guarantees because it might be booked, but I'm going to hope not, and I'm going to send off an email to my producer. Zero, what is so dangerous about zero?
Well, we actually touched upon it earlier when you were talking about the fear of death. Zero is the void. And throughout history, humans have had a lot of trouble dealing with the void. Zero is a number that has the power of infinity. Zero and infinity are actually very similar numbers. And so you've got the infinite and the void wrapped up in the same creature. And the Greeks refused to believe that zero was a number. The Italians banned it in the Renaissance. People nowadays, I mean, you'll still see people think that zero is not a number. It's we don't know how to deal with it. It destroys computers. The book opens.
Is that kind of like black is not a color?
Yeah. It's the idea that instead of thinking of it as a number, which it is, it's a number. It's even. It's between negative one and one, which are both numbers. It's not a hole in the number line. But people say, you know, zero is just not a number. It just doesn't exist. If you look at the top of your keyboard, I mean, it starts with a one and goes to zero. A zero is past nine. It's not a normal place. It's like it's a different object.
Fascinating. Well, that we can do a show on that. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Seif. Hi.
Hi, Art.
How you doing, Ann?
How are you?
Fine.
This is Ann in New Mexico. And, you know, you interviewed somebody about zero to nine, remember?
Yes.
I'm trying to find his... It was a wonderful interview, and zero is a number.
Absolutely.
And remember, he said, I am equals zero. If we can accept that and then move it up to nine, it was a fascinating interview. And, Charles, just the fact that you brought that up, wow.
I think he thought nine was a key, correct?
Yes, that was the stats. You go up to nine.
Yes.
Zero to nine, and it was fascinating. In fact, I'm looking to see my notes, and I can't find it right now.
Anyway.
But I wrote down his name. Parallel universes, two comments. Scripture says that we're sitting, even as I'm talking to you right now, I'm sitting where, although I don't believe, you said you don't believe, right? We're sitting in heavenly places right now in Messiah Yahshua. Mm-hmm. And Yahweh gives us that information in Scripture. Hallelujah. So I believe you. There are parallel universes because Scripture says so. And apparently you're on a track, too. And I hope you can get on next weekend. Now my second comment, Charles, is what you were saying about Shabtaziv. Hello?
Hello, yeah.
Yeah, Shabtaziv. Mm-hmm. Well, that Messiah, he announced his Messiahship on June 18th, 1666.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And his ideas are motivating the people in power in Israel today. They want to get rid of the Torah observant Jews, and they want to have a religion based on the exact opposite of Yahweh's intentions. That's what's motivating. It's called the Frankist vision, but it started with Sabti. And I just wanted to bring that out. When you mentioned him, I was going, wow, I've got to get on the phone.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the Torah in particular.
Yes.
If you look at the Kabbalistic teachings, the idea is that the universe is really an emanation of the Torah, that the letters which create the Torah, the information within the Torah is what creates the universe, the fabric of the universe.
Yes, I agree.
Which is in itself an emanation of God.
Yes.
So,
well, Yahweh.
I mean, in some sense, it's central to the Kabbalah is that the universe is this information which is passed down.
Yes, but I don't follow Kabbalah. I follow Scripture. And the Tetragrammaton is Yad He Vav He, raise his name, and it's Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an amazing, I'm telling you, the truths are just amazing. And what you're touching on is you're examining his manifestations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and getting back to zero, I mean, one of the manifestations is Ein Sof, the nothingness in some sense. That the void is the ultimate manifestation. It gets back. It's like a Ouroboros just kind of swallowing its tail.
Okay. Dale in Nebraska, you're on with Charles Seif.
Hi, I'm Dale. I'm from Northeast Nebraska. And really fascinating show. I wanted to thank you for keeping me from getting a good night's sleep tonight.
Sorry. But
anyway, I just happened to be reading a book called Schrodinger's Cat. I can't tell you right now who the author is, and I'm about three quarters of the way through it. So a lot of what you're saying is kind of a review. But the reason I'm calling, and I know Art has been fascinated with this over the years, there used to be what they call cold fusion possibilities. And for a lot of years, I had subscribed to a magazine that called Infinite Energy that dealt with it. Mm-hmm. And kind of hadn't heard anything about it for a long time. And last week on a television show, there was a little blurb about a high school student who is supposedly doing fusion in his garage. And then because of the winter weather, they moved it down into the basement. And they showed a little bit of it. They showed the vacuum pumps and the chamber and there was something glowing in there. And they didn't call it cold fusion. They just said fusion. And I was wondering if you had heard anything about that and hear any thoughts about cold fusion and vacuum energy or...
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, I've heard, of course, that cold fusion has taken itself to Europe. Hans and Flashman, I guess, are in Europe. Have you heard anything, Charles, lately about cold fusion?
Well, the child who was doing it is using something called electrostatic fusion, if I recall correctly. It uses electric charges to drive these nuclei together and cause them to fuse. And the problem is you can't get more energy out than you put in for this sort of thing, but it's real. Cold fusion, there's still an active community researching it. I actually went to a conference not long ago in D.C. where a bunch of cold fusion experts were getting together to discuss it. The problem is that, at least from my point of view, that the experiments aren't reproducible in multiple different labs. You have people reporting things, but it's not consistent. Mm-hmm. I think what will happen is you will definitely get these researchers continuing to do the experiments, and people will only start to look up. The skeptics will only start to be convinced when they can do it themselves. And you've got researchers all over the place doing the same experiment and getting the same result every time. And unfortunately, the experiments are not at that point yet.
Isn't it weird, though, that it works? Well, I don't know what percentage. I know a number of universities have tried it, and it seems like about 50-50. Half of them reported success, the other half not.
Mm-hmm. And early on, I mean, you got some, it was not just one group, but two groups. And it was Stephen Jones out of Brigham Young, as well as Pons and Fleischman, who were looking at this sort of stuff. And I believe that one of the early DOE experiments kind of showed something. But, you know, science is tricky, and you get null results or bad results all the time. And so reproducibility is the gold standard. I mean, that is what prevents, I mean, even fraud. You get scientific fraud all the time. I mean, the magazine I worked for, Science, was hit by this Korean scandal having to do with cloning.
Oh, yes.
And what allows science to progress, despite malfeasance, is the fact that no one really believes something until it's reproducible and done over and over and over again. And this is actually a problem, especially when you've got a very expensive piece of equipment that can't be...
So half the time in good universities is not good enough for science. It's got to be all the time.
That's correct. That's correct, or close to all the time. Because, you know, we humans are very, very good at deceiving ourselves.
Hmm.
And science is supposed to be a tool to help us get through the deception. But of course, I mean, scientists are human too. And scientists deceive themselves all the time.
First time caller line, Michael in New Orleans. You're on with Charles Sci-Fi.
Hi, Charles, and Art. Glad to. I'm first time caller. There's a few things that have been so many tangents just listening to everybody, and a few things that are interesting to me. My background has a lot to do with instrumentation, and we have cell phones now. And if you have a clock in your cell phone, you're probably accurate to within, better than a second, And right now, if you put some ideas out that were revolutionary, Princeton may register that on their egg machine. And one of the things that I've been trying to find an answer to, Charles may just be the person that may have this on the tip of his fingers, tip of his tongue, tip of his mind. There's a limit, probably, to energy density. Like, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? How many photons can you put in a cubic centimeter before you start seeing similar phenomena to, say, black holes? And this phenomena actually can happen. I believe it's 1.5 times the radius. It's out from the black hole center. Mm-hmm. You have a point where light is trapped. There's no centripetal or centrifugal force. They're balanced. Are you familiar, Charles?
Yes. Actually, yes.
Okay. Now, in that strange event, you could have not just huge amounts of matter concentrated in a black hole, but what happens when you start having intense energy to where you may be able to have, say, like an antimatter fusion? You know, if somebody's ideas are actually novel, this may register on an egg machine.
Mm-hmm.
Just by putting it out there to enough people. You know, it may be the beginning of something here. We may be doing an experiment. Okay. The other idea, do you know of a number? Is there a way to quantify, you know, numerically what that phenomenal level is?
No one knows what that limit is where all of a sudden, I mean, and there will be a transition when you get beyond a certain energy density
now,
to a black hole sort of thing.
Yeah.
And no one knows where that limit is. It is possible, and some have speculated, that we'll actually be able to reach that energy density with this LHC collider, which is coming online very shortly in Switzerland. It is possible that we'd be able to create tiny little black holes
right. With
that collider.
Very spooky. Burton Richter, we'd done some work. I was with a large corporation, and we did some work with electrostatic cooling back mm-hmm. in the early 1980s. And some of the work we did has led to things like ion engines. And mm-hmm. the work we specifically did was creating mean free paths at ambient conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's really, you know, they're out working on some interesting xenon engines, you know. But no one's really working on ion propulsion. Imagine a jet engine that wouldn't have, you know, propellers or turbine blades. It could actually propel itself, you know, by electrostatically charging and repelling air.
Mm-hmm.
All these things that are right in the realm of possibilities now. 200 years ago, a radio, the idea that we could unambiguously communicate a thought across oceans. You know, even now we talk about ESP and does it exist, does it not exist. Look how phenomenal, you know, the technology, the magic has brought us to a point. Some people are saying we're headed towards possibly a singularity. You know, we really are at a jumping off point almost.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was good. It is strange. I'm coming home tonight. We're doing some work tonight, and I'm driving home and tuned into the program. The other little seminal thought that I wanted to toss out, you're familiar with the Broglie, wavelength?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was a couple of equations rattling around. Planck was a big fan of Einstein's, I believe, and sort of championed him and gave him, you know, what he needed to become a success. And Planck had said E equals H nu, and
mm-hmm.
H was his constant, nu was frequency. Einstein says E equals MC squared. This lays around for a few years before de Broglie says, hey, if E equals MC squared, it also equals H nu. How is H nu, you know, how is Planck's constant frequency, mass, and energy all related? And it leads to mass spectroscopy, you know, and a whole bunch of things that are real intense and, you know, hard to appreciate. But, there's a lot of these things that are amazing to me, how things will lay around and people talk themselves out of seeing things that are sitting right there in front of them. And one of them that is a curiosity to me, and people are tired of hearing me bring it up, but we'll get into conversation sometime, and I'll say, well, see, you know, could Einstein have said, let's make something a yardstick? So the speed of light was a good one. And you know, it's worked real well. But he even has this divergence between special and general relativity. And then you try and back into why do we have discrepancies? Why did he not like quantum theory? And now quantum theory is starting to get the upper hand. Well, another little thing that's a curiosity to me, you can say it's valid to juggle the equation and say the speed of light, C, is equal to the square root of energy over mass.
Now, when you go to a scribe, what does this mean? Well, could it possibly mean that the speed of light may be tied to distributions of energy and mass in different areas of the universe?
All right, we'll have to hold it there. Charles, go ahead and comment.
Okay, well, first I'd like to thank you for working on ion and electrostatic engines, because I have to say they are really, really neat. And ion engines, along with Hall effect thrusters, which are really doing some great stuff in space, and I'd love to see them work on Earth a little more. So let me thank you for that. It seems from what we can tell that Einstein chose right, C as the yardstick, as that which is constant is in fact right, because what you can do is you can look at different areas with different mass densities, like the center of a dense galaxy versus free space. And from what they can tell, there is no variation in C. It's possible. I mean, I haven't thought about this enough to say whether it could be that if you changed some of the equations and kind of twiddled with it, you might be able to get a consistent picture where C varies and it's dependent upon square root of E over M. But from my understanding, that switch wouldn't quite work, because it would affect the spectra that you're seeing from dense galaxies. I think that's a very good thought, because some of the things that Einstein took for granted, the constant speed of light, are being questioned by scientists. And things that you take for granted, you realize it's sitting before you, as you said, that maybe that's not a valid assumption, and all of a sudden your world has changed.
Charles, your books, available: Decoding the Universe, Alpha and Omega, The Search for the Beginning and End of the Universe, and Zero, The Biography of a Dangerous Idea, all available at Amazon?
That's correct.
Okay. So this time I'm not going to say goodbye. I'm going to say, and I believe we can do it, to be continued next weekend.
I'm looking forward to it.
Charles, you've been an incredible guest. See you next weekend.
Thank you so much.
Good night. And good night. Everybody out there, thank you and good night.